From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Jane Clayson in Boston. It's Here and Now. In a meeting today, OPEC and their allies decided against new oil production increases. They'll stick with planned moderate increases. Despite a lot of public pressure, oil is pushing a seven-year high, around $80 a barrel. And gas prices are spiking, now near $200 a barrel. All that has big implications for the rest of the economy. For more, let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, CBS Business News analyst and host of Jill on Money. Jill, welcome. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday to you.
So OPEC plus allies like Russia decided not to push increases in oil production beyond these modest monthly increases that they'd already agreed upon last July. Tell us about this decision and its impact.
Well, I think that most of the analysts, at least that I spoke to, said that they thought this is what was going to happen, that, you know, back in July, that OPEC nations, including others, the plus, agreed to raise output by 400,000 barrels a day in October, November, and probably for every month, at least until April of 2022. And that was an effort to phase out 5.8 million barrels per day of existing cuts. Now, what does this move really tell us? It tells me, at least, that oil prices are going to remain high for at least the remainder of this year. I'm sorry, gang, especially if you're thinking about your holiday travels. And frankly, if output, the amount of oil, continues to fall short of the group's target, we could see oil prices remain pretty high well into next year.
And how is the U.S. responding to all this? Will U.S. frackers, for example, increase their production?
You know, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on which side of the fracking debate you're on, U.S. shale producers actually cannot catch up as quickly as would need be. You know, and it's interesting because remember that the shale producers, which saw this enormous economic benefit, then got crushed amid the COVID recession, kind of shut things down. It's just really hard to ramp up production really quickly. So I don't think that that's going to happen anytime soon, which would mean that we're sort of also keeping an eye on Iran nuclear negotiations to see if that spigot gets turned on. But again, between the shale producers and the talks between Iran taking a while, it does look like OPEC is in the driver's seat right now.
So big picture then, what can we expect moving forward with oil prices? And what other industries and economic goods might be impacted?
I mean, this is the problem when we report on inflation data, because often, you know, a knucklehead like me will say, okay, here's what happened with inflation. For example, the most recent report, inflation was up 5.3%. But when we take out food and energy, it was up a more modest 4%. Well, when you take out food and energy, you're taking out the things that really do impact the wallets of ordinary Americans. So what we are seeing is that oil prices have increased by about 60% since the summer of 2020, and that trickles down through lots of different areas. So we know, obviously, the price of a gallon of regular gas is up dramatically, up by almost a full dollar from a year ago at $3.20. If you look at other aspects of the energy situation and you look into, say, that CPI report, you can see that oil is also up dramatically. That actually trickles into the electricity costs. So if you look at all of energy, energy prices are up dramatically by almost 25% from a year ago. And this is what is hurting ordinary Americans whose wages are not keeping track with that at all, in any way, shape, or form.
Right. Well, it feels like every week we're talking about this crazy rally in oil and gas prices. Seems like a faraway issue on stock trader screens, but talk about, you know, how this is hitting consumers here at home. As you mentioned, holiday travel will be here before you know it.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that this has a real issue in terms of economic growth overall. You know, we have a very difficult situation because we are seeing that the price of energy going up dramatically is creating burgeoning inflation and continues to keep that those numbers high. And it also actually has a chance, potentially, of slowing down economic growth at the wrong time, obviously, right, as we hopefully are coming away from the entire COVID era. So look, it's where we are today, and we hope we get better tomorrow. But I would say count on high energy costs for the foreseeable future.
Well, that's Jill Schlesinger, CBS Business News analyst and host of Jill on Money, with the bad news today, Jill. As
Sorry.
Always, thank you. Thank you very much.
Take care.
Last month, some 30,000 migrants from Haiti crossed into the Del Rio, Texas area. Thousands have been sent back to Mexico or flown to Haiti, according to U.S. government numbers. But some migrants have been released into Del Rio, and several thousand are seeking asylum in the United States. Now, questions remain as to how prepared the government was and whether a next wave of migrants is coming. For more on this, let's bring in James Dobbins. He's covering this for the New York Times, and he's in San Antonio. James, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott. Glad to be here.
Sure. First, what's the latest in Del Rio? The massive camp, as I understand it, has been emptied out. Is there a sense of calm or relief?
Well, there's certainly a sense of relief, and the camp has been cleared out for more than a week now, and the bridge between Mexico and the U.S. in Del Rio is reopened. So there's still a lot of questions about how this happened, how unprepared the U.S. government was to address this problem, that local politicians certainly have been voicing concern since the beginning of the year.
What do we know about how prepared the U.S. government was or should have been? We're learning customs and border protection numbers, saw migrant numbers in the Del Rio area spike way back in May. How much of a surprise was it really?
I don't think it was a surprise for the agents on the ground, and certainly not locals, like I said, who are concerned that they were seeing increasing numbers crossing in that sector for months. And what was done to be prepared here in this case, it was simply a matter of the stations where migrants are processed normally were overloaded, and there was no more space to put them to process any faster. They couldn't, the U.S. government didn't have the capacity. So what appears to occur here in the Del Rio sector, in order to sort of make a queue, this camp was created, and migrants were sort of directed to this camp to await processing.
And I want to ask you about this question of clarity. Does it seem, at least up until now, that these migrants were receiving, in some cases, mixed signals, whether it was true or misinformation that, oh, there's a chance you can get released into the U.S., there's a chance you can get an asylum hearing. I mean, was that, to some degree, the word that was going around as far as these migrants and the question of whether and when to go north?
It was a gamble on their part, but they certainly received encouraging signals from people they knew who've crossed before them. They also felt that the messaging with the new Biden administration, they assumed that it would, the Trump administration era crackdown on migrants, those attitudes were lifting. That was the perception that it was going to be easier to cross. Unfortunately, that's not true. Nothing has really changed. Title 42, which is the CDC health guidance that allows Border Patrol to expel people based on the COVID crisis, is still in effect. And we saw that play out here very much with the deportations, which is a huge shock to many of the Haitians who were in the camp and when they learned that deportations were happening under Title 42. But there's also another aspect to it where that's the pull, if you can think about it, as the draw towards the United States. Mm-hmm. But there was a push. A lot of these migrants were living for years in Chile. And there, with the COVID closures of many businesses, and also a general anti-migrant and refugee attitude, a racist attitude by some people in the country against Blacks and Haitians in particular, pushed this group away from that country and towards the United States, simply out of survival. I certainly spoke to a woman who's, when she was living there with her relatives as a migrant, her cousin was murdered. And that was really the red flag for that family to escape, to leave, and make that treacherous journey through the jungles between Colombia and Panama and up to the United States, and finally arriving in that camp in Del Rio.
So, James, when you put together these pushes from Chile and other countries and these pulls or potential pulls or signals that migrants might be receiving from the United States, what's the possibility that we'll see another chapter of this?
We will. There's already reports from Central America that potentially another 70,000 people are moving north. Where they will end up, it's unknown. They may stay in Mexico, or they may try to find a way into the United States, either trying to evade Border Patrol or actually, as many Haitians did at the bridge, seek asylum. And the current numbers we're seeing now are as high as they were in 2000. So I don't think this is going to end anytime soon.
That is James Dobbins of the New York Times. James, thanks again for taking the time.
Thank you.
The CDC has an urgent recommendation that pregnant women get vaccinated against COVID-19. This group is also eligible for booster shots. A new study finds that the Delta variant is far more risky to pregnant people than earlier strains. Hospitalizations and critical cases of COVID for this group have jumped to 15%. Thing is, only about a third of pregnant women are vaccinated. One of those who did choose the vaccine and the booster is emergency room physician An Nguyen. She treats patients at Houston Methodist Hospital. Dr. Nguyen, thanks for joining us. Now, we know pregnancy is so stressful, and yet the head of the CDC says these vaccines are very safe for pregnant people. Could be a tough call. Why did you get the booster?
For me, when I weighed the risks and benefits, it was abundantly clear that the benefits of the vaccine far outweighed the risks. I mean, I work in the ER, so I see COVID patients daily. And I've read and seen so many cases of pregnant women, especially in the third trimester, getting horrifically ill with the virus. And, you know, at first I too was hesitant because pregnant women were excluded from the trials. But as time has gone on over the last, you know, 9-10 months, more and more pregnant women have gotten vaccinated, and the data currently appears to be extraordinarily safe for pregnant women.
Yeah. Now, some pregnant women are surely worried about the side effects. What was your experience? Side effects?
Oh, absolutely. So with the second shot, I had some chills. I had some body aches. But with the third shot, given that I was already 34 weeks pregnant at the time, the fatigue hit me like a hammer.
But I guess surely the benefit cost calculation is a pretty clean answer for you.
Absolutely. And every mom wants the best for her baby. You know, we've seen cases of stillbirths, preterm labor, cases of, you know, having to emergently deliver a mom, and then either the mom or the baby not doing well. Third trimester mom's currently pregnant, getting intubated, and I just knew I did not want that to be me.
Now, despite what you've seen, the percentage of pregnant women being vaccinated is still quite low. You have interacted with these pregnant patients in some cases who have COVID-19. Mm-hmm. Help us to understand a little bit more the concerns you hear from these patients.
So, absolutely, I understand. When you're pregnant, you're responsible for more than just yourself. And I do think the messaging was a little bit confusing in the beginning, because when Pfizer and Moderna released their data, pregnant women were excluded from the study. So the ideal situation is to not do anything unknown, is to not put anything unknown into your body and not get COVID. But at this point, with Delta surging, it's so contagious and so deadly that I don't think that you can really sequester yourself at this point and make yourself zero risk. And that's what most women say. They're like, I could just stay at home. I could just try my best and not get it. But I just don't think that that's, you know, possible at this point.
Now we have more data. In August, 22 pregnant women died of COVID-19 in this country, and that's the highest monthly number since the pandemic started. And the number of cases among pregnant women also doubled from 500 to 1,000 a week from June through August. So for those who say, well, you know, I'm not sure how much data there is on this, what's your answer?
I think that the data is there in terms of safety. I mean, there's several kind of reporting mechanisms out there. There's VAERS, the federal database. There's also something called VSafe, where pregnant women kind of self-identify as pregnant and getting the shot. And then they self-report kind of symptoms, side effects. I have not read of any cases where the vaccine itself has caused stillbirth, premature labor, moms getting intubated or going to the ICU. But on the other hand, as you mentioned, I've seen plenty of maternal deaths, stillbirths, child deaths. So I just don't think it's anything that you can compare. unfortunately, a lot of the people I see already have COVID, but there's significant regret in not doing something they could have done to protect their child. Because again, as a mom, all moms just want to do the right thing by their children. I think when I lead by example, you know, I'm 35 weeks pregnant, so I have a large belly, so they can definitely identify with my decision to get the shot. And, you know, me just showing that with all the knowledge I have, with all the things that I've seen, that this is something I'm willing to take myself, I think that gives them a lot of confidence. And I try to approach it in a non-judgmental fashion, and that maybe gives them a little bit of confidence that I'm not trying to persuade them to do something that I myself wouldn't do.
What are you seeing at Houston Methodist Hospital in terms of pregnant patients? We have read about capacity issues, space issues, workforce limitations. What does it look like now?
So I would say in the last month, August and September, were our highest COVID numbers ever. And pregnancy is such a stressful time for your body as it is. You're immunocompromised. When you get to your third trimester, your lung function is decreased. You are then put in this category of the same as like if you were a smoker, if you were a diabetic, because you just can't fight the bug that well. And everyone I see, they're pretty ill, especially women in their third trimester. And I would have significant concern for women who are catching it early in their pregnancy as well.
And finally, what do we know about immunity for the baby, whether the vaccines, whether the boosters, you know, transmit much of that immunity?
Yeah. So, I mean, physiologically, whatever's circulating in my blood will go to the baby. And, you know, it has been shown many times over that pregnant women pass antibodies on to their children. And while I'm pregnant, I'm passing it on, I would say, in more of like a complete way versus when I'm breastfeeding to the child. So kind of to me, it was a little bit of a golden opportunity to give my child some passive immunity while I can. So that's an added bonus, I would say.
That is Houston Methodist Hospital emergency physician An Nguyen, who is in week 35, of your pregnancy.
Yes.
And recently received her booster shot. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Scott.
More than one in seven people living in the United States identify with a mysterious racial category. It's called, quote, some other race. And it's now the second largest racial group after white, according to the latest census. That's a big problem for protecting people's civil rights. NPR's census correspondent Hansi Luong reports.
For two people I interviewed, the census question about race has been almost impossible to answer.
I actually remember calling my dad and saying, what race are you putting? I don't know what to put.
I almost want to just skip that question, to be honest.
That was Leyani Garcia Torres.
I live in Brooklyn, New York.
And Frank Alvarez.
I'm from Los Angeles, California.
For the 2020 census, both of them identified as Hispanic or Latino, which is an ethnicity, according to the federal government, and not a race. Alvarez and Garcia Torres say the racial categories that were on the form didn't really fit them. Not the boxes for American Indian or Alaska Native, Asian and Pacific Islander groups, Black or white.
Both of my parents are from the island of Puerto Rico.
Growing up, you know, we were in a very traditional Guatemalan home.
We're just historically pretty mixed.
I think I just identify with my ethnicity.
If you look at anyone in my family, you wouldn't really be able to guess a race. We just look vaguely tan, I would say.
So for last year's headcount, Garcia Torres and Alvarez were among the nearly 50 million people who checked off some other race or wrote in an answer the Census Bureau sorted into that category. And more than 90% of that group is Latino.
This is a red flag. It's been a red flag that's been around for a very long time.
Cristina Mora is a sociologist at UC Berkeley who studies race and ethnicity. Mora says the some other race category is obscuring the identities of many Latinx people, and that makes it harder to enforce anti-discrimination laws.
If we're not represented in the data, we're never going to have a true sense of racial justice. We're never really going to have a sense of who is this rapidly growing, dynamic, and diverse population in this country.
After the 2000 count, the Census Bureau almost got rid of the some other race category. Officials thought that could have helped more Latinos answer the race question.
For a long time, there was the sense that there wasn't anything wrong with the question.
This is Clara Rodriguez, a sociologist at Fordham University and author of Changing Race, Latinos, the Census, and the History of Ethnicity in the United States.
But rather that Hispanics didn't understand the question. And I remember thinking, wow, some other race was something to be taken seriously, not to be dismissed as a misunderstanding.
The Census Bureau did propose changing its questions for last year's count. Research showed that if it combined the two separate questions about Latino origins and race into one, it could reduce the share of people identifying as some other race, and it would not skew the shares of Latinos who also identify as Black or white. But that change required approval from the White House's Office of Management and Budget during former President Donald Trump's administration, and that didn't happen. Now that planning has started for the next census, Nancy Lopez, who is a sociologist at the University of New Mexico, wants to see a different kind of race question added.
Not every Latino is a brown-skinned Latino. There are white Latinos. There are Black Latinos like myself. And there are Latinos who are also street race Asian.
People's street race, Lopez says, is what they think strangers assume their race to be.
The national guidelines need to understand that discrimination is happening based on how you look, right? The visual cues that people assume represent something about you.
It's important to be able to click a box that says who we are instead of what we're not.
Julissa Arce is an immigrant from Mexico who now lives in Los Angeles. Last year, she clicked the boxes for American Indian, Chinese, and some other race.
We've been here since before it was called the United States. And I think we deserve to be accurately represented.
And for Arce, that means having a racial category on the 2030 census for Latino. Anzila Wong, NPR News.
Cleanup is underway for a major oil spill off the coast of Orange County in Southern California. The leak spans at least 5.8 nautical miles. It's believed to have stemmed from a pipeline that connects an offshore oil platform to the shore. Huntington Beach Mayor Kim Carr said at a briefing yesterday that to protect public health, local beaches could be closed for weeks or even months.
I am very much attached to the beach. My husband's a surfer. My daughter's been part of the junior guards here forever. And this is the main reason why we live in Huntington Beach. And so to see the environmental impact on our shore, to me, it's absolutely devastating.
Environmentalists are concerned about long-term impacts to wildlife. Joining us now is Eric Likas, a reporter with the Orange County Register. Eric, this oil spill was first reported on Saturday. What do we know about it so far?
Well, the CEO of Amplify Energy, which is the parent company of Beta Offshore, which runs the well, told reporters on Sunday that the leak was discovered after an oily sheen was found during an inspection on Saturday morning. They said authorities were notified right away, and later that day, oil started to reach the shores of Huntington Beach and then Newport Beach as well. People were advised to stay away from all beaches in Huntington Beach and Newport Beach, and they were warning of potential effects like irritation to the eyes, ear, and throat, and possible vomiting. We've heard of massive environmental impacts, but the extent is unclear.
Well, the U.S. Coast Guard is leading the cleanup off the coast of Orange County, and temporary barriers called booms have been set up around wetlands to soak up the oil. Do we know how well those are working?
Well, I spoke with Administrator Tim Cullen of Fish and Wildlife, and he said that there have been a significant amount of resources to prevent that oil from further penetrating into the marshlands, but it's still evident that much more is needed. When describing his observations, he said that this may be possibly the worst spill since 2015 near Santa Barbara. And that leak, I think that was an estimated report of over 140,000 gallons of oil.
And there have been reports of dead birds and fish washing up near the oil slick. You mentioned some of the environmental impact here. What else have we learned about that?
Well, we are still in the earlier stages of assessing that. Anecdotally, we're seeing people, you know, finding pelicans slicked in oil. There is thankfully a specific facility in Huntington Beach that can take care of these animals, specifically animals impacted by oil slicks and environmental disasters like this.
Well, the company responsible for the spill, as you mentioned, is Beta Offshore. That's a subsidiary of Amplify Energy Corporation. And Martin Wilshire is president and CEO of Amplify Energy. He spoke yesterday in a news conference, and I want to play a clip of that.
We will do everything in our power to ensure that this is recovered as quickly as possible. And we won't be done until this is concluded.
And do we know how long that might take?
That is a question a lot of people are asking at this time. When it was posed to Coast Guard officials on Sunday during that press briefing, they simply described it as potentially an extended engagement and wouldn't go into further detail.
Cleanup still underway on this major oil spill off the coast of Orange County in Southern California. Eric Likas, reporter with the Orange County Register. Eric, thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
The whistleblower who exposed internal documents from Facebook has gone public. Francis Haugen spoke to CBS's 60 Minutes about how the company's algorithms encourage discord, harm users' mental health, and facilitate violence.
Facebook has realized that if they change the algorithm to be safer, people will spend less time on the site, they'll click on less ads, they'll make less money.
Haugen is set to testify before Congress this week, and these revelations about social media give new fuel to old debates about the internet and how it works. What should the rules be? Who should be in charge? Well, a new book takes on these questions. It's called Four Internets: Data, Geopolitics, and the Governance of Cyberspace. And one of its authors joins me now. Kieran O'Hara is Associate Professor in Electronics and Computer Science at the University of Southampton in the UK. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Now, Kieran, you and your co-author, Wendy Hall, describe the internet as not one digital space or idea, but as a splinternet. I mean, originally, I think I remember there was what you call the Silicon Valley open internet, you know, free ideas, free exchange, free love, the original incarnation. What happened?
Well, it's very interesting. It was a lovely ideal, I think, that libertarian West Coast ideal. What happened was problems began to emerge, not at the beginning when there were just a few scientists using it or people using it in good faith, using it for more or less the same reasons, but when very large numbers of people began to use the internet. So, for example, there were problems with privacy. There were problems with social stability, misinformation, problems, things like that. And as a result, different people, different groups, different political groups have started to have different answers to the question, what is the internet for?
Right. And one of the answers that you write about is the Chinese government's answer to it. You call this the paternal internet, you know, walling off certain political ideas, imposing surveillance. I lived for a number of years in China. I have to say, I kind of got used to it. But China is also where companies perfected this technology and are kind of exporting it. Is this a growing space, this paternal internet?
It is. I think to an extent, any government is keen to ensure that the internet has what it sees as good effects. But China takes this certainly to an extreme. China, as you know, I don't need to tell you, China has a very strong view about social stability and about the Communist Party as being the top of the hierarchy. But if any government, I think, is interested in making sure that the internet is not a disruptive force. And so lots of governments are interested in learning from China and what China's doing to the internet.
Yeah, I mean, as you're saying, this model is being kind of borrowed from or adapted in other countries. Do you have an example of a place where there's kind of this emerging version of the paternal internet?
Well, China is very keen to export its own technology through what's called the Belt and Road Initiative. And there are lots of places, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa or the Middle East, where Chinese technology is being used to create what are called smart cities, cities with lots of sensors and surveillance to enable things like congestion or carbon emissions or crime to be managed more effectively.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the I get what some of us in the U.S. would describe as Big Brother, but I can kind of understand the thinking from those who are wanting to borrow from that. Tell me about, I guess, internet number three, as you write about, the bourgeois internet. This is where governing authorities, notably in Europe, want to make sure to protect privacy and protect data. So if you're a company in this space or an individual who wants to be in this space, you have to adhere to some of these, say, data protection rules before you can even kind of join and be a player in the bourgeois internet. Is that it?
Exactly that. Yeah. So the example, I think, of the General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR, which came into force in Europe in 2018, that's very powerful. That has worldwide reach. And when any company wants to process data anywhere in the world about an EU citizen, it had better make sure that it's adhering to GDPR. And it does have global reach. The first prosecution, I think, under GDPR was a Canadian company. This is a very different approach to the American approach to data and personally identifying information. And there are a number of American companies that have had to, that have felt they've had to pull out of Europe, and they, that you can't get to their websites from there. More normally, the idea is that for a big multinational company, it's actually easier to adhere to one set of standards, and Europe wants to see itself as the standard setter.
Okay. And finally, many Americans, but internet netizens in other places are familiar with what you call the commercial internet, right? Google wants to keep me in its orbit with its products, its empire, I guess. So is Facebook, so is Amazon. And in other countries, so is WeChat. So given these commercial behemoths, I would imagine this model has staying power, yeah?
I think it clearly does. The idea here is we just view the internet as a piece of property, and you can own bits of it, and we look for market solutions to problems. And if you can make monopoly profits, that's fine, as long as you're innovating, as long as there's value to the consumer, to the user, through your innovations, you're allowed to do that. Now, that model... As you say, it's a very attractive model for a lot of reasons. A lot of there's a lot of money to be made.
Sure.
It was under pressure at the end of the Trump administration. Certainly under pressure under the Biden administration through antitrust law and antitrust efforts. And I think the reason for that partly is that it's one of the relatively few things that both sides of the American polarized political divide agree on, that the tech companies might just be a bit more powerful than politicians in Washington would prefer.
Yeah, one of the teeny tiny spaces where we have some bipartisan thinking. there is the role of the technology companies. I want to ask you whether there's any inherently anything wrong with this. I mean, when I first read about, I'm going to talk about the four internets, my immediate inclination was, four horsemen, right? The apocalypse is coming. Something is wrong here. But perhaps is this just the way things are?
I think that's a good point. That's a very good point. And I do agree with that. But it would be lovely if everyone across the globe respected human rights or respected private property, but they don't. Governments are going to censor. Governments are going to have their own views about what are happening. And they're going to interfere. And what we've got to do, ideally, is keep the internet going, keep it connected, while still leaving everybody space to do their own thing online, even if we don't like it.
Mm. And can I ask you finally about one additional constituency, as it were, and that is the hackers. I mean, cybercrime. I just read that it may be the world's third largest economy for how much money we're talking about. That's a Walmart revenue times 12. I mean, how does that fit into all this, or is this, you know, planet number five?
And my co-author, Wendy Hall, and I thought a lot about this because it is such an important part of the internet, the hacker community. Clearly, there are countries who live by hacking. You know, Russia sees the internet, I think, as a way of attacking the West. So how does it fit in? It's not. We didn't see that as a fifth internet because it needs an internet to be parasitic upon. It's parasitic upon an internet, but it needs someone else to run it. It is important, I think, when we think about how the internet is run, how can we establish, and again, we were talking about the internet being divided into various constituencies and four internets. It's important not only that we keep the internet connected, but that we cooperate in seeing off the hackers, if we possibly can.
That is Kieran O'Hara talking via the internet. He's co-author with Wendy Hall of the book Four Internets: Data, Geopolitics, and the Governance of Cyberspace. Kieran is also associate professor at the University of Southampton in the UK. Thanks for the time.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed that. Thank you.
For 1 week every year, the population of the small town of Meeker, Colorado, grows by more than 100. 100 dogs, that is. That's because the farming and ranching community hosts one of the premier sheepdog trials in the U.S. After the pandemic pause in 2020, the competition returned this fall, and Colorado Public Radio's Stina Sieg was there.
At the Meeker Classic Sheepdog Championship Trials, penned-up sheep wait to be herded around a vast, deep green field. Surrounding it, people amble through a festival area, past a vendor selling signs that declare, "Border collies leave paw prints on your heart." But sit in the stands, and it can be a roller coaster.
Look at that.
Nice.
So much elation as a crouching dog finally urges a flock of reluctant sheep into a pen. I ask Rita Larson and Jean Kochesberger if they get nervous for the dogs.
Yeah. I go home exhausted.
We work as hard as they do.
The friends have traveled here for years. Larson from Grand Junction, Colorado, and Kochesberger from Magnolia, Texas.
And we've sat through rainstorms, snowstorms,
wind.
Yeah. We've done it all.
Neither own border collies. Larson used to, but hers died years ago. With a fond smile, she says these dogs are why they keep coming back.
They have such heart, and they work so hard. They're just great.
Smart and loyal, they hardly even bark. Okay, that's Clem, and her owner says barking is how she claps. But most of these sheepdogs are like Kip, silently taking in the whole scene.
He's obsessed with sheep. He's obsessed. If you watched him before our run, he was watching, hypnotized by the sheep.
Handler Diana Silvestri says that in the 5 years they've competed together, Kip has transformed.
You take a little puppy that's afraid of everything, and suddenly they become this self-confident powerhouse and bring you along in so many different ways.
The duo from Oakland, California, made it into the finals today. They didn't win, but Silvestri is honored to be here.
This is one of the best trials in the United States, if not the best.
In a town of just a few thousand people. This all started in 1987 because Meeker needed an economic boost. Someone suggested a sheepdog trial, and former mayor Gus Hollandris decided to put one on with no previous experience.
And there's no formula. You just get lucky and never quit.
That first year drew 76 dogs and just over 2,000 attendees. It's more than doubled in size since then and brings in about $1 million each year to the local economy. Hollandris has traveled a lot and says he's met Meeker Classic fans all over the world.
Let people know you're from Meeker, Colorado, and all of a sudden you're starting to talk dogs.
Hollandris and his wife Christine are watching the field intently as a famous handler uses a whistle to communicate with his dog, guiding sheep through a series of complex moves.
He made it.
What they need to do now is persuade the sheep wearing collars into a pen without touching them and close the gate. But the sheep keep trying to bolt. Hollandris looks nervous. Time is running out. Fast.
34 seconds. Can you believe that? Come on.
and they started with 30 minutes. Soon it's 10 seconds left. 9. 8.
Oh, please go.
They make it with only 2 seconds remaining.
You see what I mean? Wow. Isn't that exciting? I mean, they would do this for Tom Brady.
After the delirium, I find handler Scott Glenn and his 10-year-old sheepdog, Alice. He says he got lucky.
If I could have got lucky about 10 minutes earlier, my heart would be better shape.
But for Glenn, here from Alberta, Canada, that uncertainty is part of the addiction. He says this is something you can never master.
You'll have the odd time you'd be close to mastering it, but you'll never master it. Because there's, for one thing, there's another beast out there to show you that you're not as smart as you thought you were.
He doesn't know it yet, but they've won. Between October 5th and 10th, they'll compete at the national championships in Virginia, which they've also won before. Glenn hopes Alice will get to be top dog there one more time before she retires. For Here and Now, I'm Stina Sieg.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jane Clayson in Boston.
And in Washington, D.C., I'm Scott Tong. This is Here and Now.